rather than I've got a problem, I'm going to have a little chat with ChatGPT to solve a problem. This thing is just running in the background all the time.
Point two, a lot of these apps are what I call single user apps.
The AI models are actually better at checking their own code that they just wrote than writing it in the first place. We're starting to see management replaced by agents.
And guess who is a step or two removed? It could be your boss, or it could be your boss's boss.
And we're seeing objections from local folks about data centers. So yes, there is pressure on finding other places. Space? You know, we all collectively kind of laugh at that, but
it's still a fraction of 1%, and they're no longer the boogeyman because data centers AI have become the boogeyman 10,000 to 100,000 times faster than the GPUs. What the treasury companies do, and they have different models, but what Saylor in particular has done initially was issue equity and debt, including convertible debt. I've got a problem. The physics of Bitcoin book.
Welcome to the OrionX Download Podcast. Join Shaheen Khan, the OrionX analysts, and special guests as they discuss and simplify the big ideas and technology that are changing the world. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the OrionX Download Analyst Roundtable. This is episode number 13th of what we fondly call ART. With me, as usual, Adrian Cockcroft, Steve Perrineau, Chris Kruhl. Gentlemen, how are you?
Doing fine.
Hi, thank you.
Doing well,
thank
you. All right. We have a good roster as usual. Let's start with what's going on in the industry. We talked about massive IPOs coming, AI, crypto, quantum, interconnects, the usual, and let's see how much of it we can cover. Adrian, you want to lead the IPO stuff?
Yeah. There's been a couple of blog posts by Paul Kodrowski, who's basically been looking at the market and saying, well, there's the SpaceX IPO coming this summer, and then Anthropic and OpenAI. And the total market capital of those IPOs is unprecedented. It's in the many trillions of dollars. And that's going to suck maybe around $1 trillion worth of actual cash into those companies. And that money has to come from somewhere. He's basically pointing out the problem, and then the question is, what happens when you try to suck $1 trillion out of the market to put in these places? Because people believe in AI companies, lots of excitement. There's lots of people want to invest in them, but they're going to have to cash money out from somewhere else, and it's going to at least put a dampener on some places where people store their cash, with, you know, whether it's markets, crypto, or their savings. What do you think, guys?
Well, we were saying, concluding earlier, that the valuation of these IPOs would be around $5 trillion-ish, mm-hmm. you know, over the course of a few months. And back of the envelope, that means probably maybe $1 trillion out of pocket. And we've got 7-ish million floating around in the money market accounts. So not everybody's going to withdraw 15% of their money market to go after this. So it's going to come from somewhere. So I think that we'll see an impact with people cashing out where they've had some big gains. You know, you look at the chip companies, the AI companies existing. I think we're going to see a flow to that.
I just wonder if people are prepared to increase their net exposure at this point. There is a lot of cash on the sidelines, but that's because the boomers have the money and the boomers are a little cautious. And I think there is a cautious tone in the market now, despite the new highs, because people perceive stagflation, right? We've got higher inflation report, got more uncertainty around unemployment because of exactly these offerings, right? Because of AI. So I suspect that people will be rotating, as Chris was kind of suggesting, and as Adrian was suggesting, taking funds from other places, but not drawing down their cash reserves very much. So, you know, we'll see some of the market sell off, perhaps, to fund these IPOs.
Like profit taking?
Profit taking from NVIDIA, etc. You know, from the Magnificent Seven, where already 40% of the market cap is, in order to try to accommodate these. We're at historic highs for imbalance, and typically the market tends to crash when you get to 40, 42%. I don't know if 42 is a magic number here, but around 40%. That tends to be a peak, and that's what we've got. You know, seven stocks have about 40%.
So when you guys were talking about this, I thought that, okay, SpaceX is targeting something like $1.75 trillion IPO with what they said was an unusually high fraction of the shares being sold, like up to 30% compared to the typical 5 to 10% is what I read. And my thought was that, okay, if you're buying that now, how much bigger do you expect it to get? Do you expect it to become $20 trillion, $10 trillion, five? Now, we have existing evidence that that can happen with NVIDIA, Microsoft, you know, the Magnificent Seven, who are all kind of trading up there in that valuation. But I suppose that's what that is, right? Because you're buying it because you think it's going to multiply bigger number, right?
Well, what typically happens after an IPO is that it goes to a fraction of what it was worth.
And then it comes back.
Right. So it starts off at 1.75 trillion and it ends up at, you know, 500 billion for a while, and then gradually climbs back up as the actual profit appears. So there's
right.
that enthusiasm for the IPO. Quite, I mean, almost all the ones I can think of, there was a dip afterwards. Mm. Before it came back up. So they have to be, you have to be generating a lot of cash in order to really sustain your post-IPO thing,
right.
post-IPO levels. And I think it's mostly enthusiasm driving this more than, you know, fundamentals.
I think we need a metric for our podcast of how long it takes before we have to say this is not investment advice.
So, yeah.
This time it's about 6.5 minutes.
Well, some of the parties on this podcast will be giving divestment advice.
But, yeah. I'm currently in the selling everything and holding cash kind of. Sell high, right? It's high. Sell high.
Adrian's on the sidelines.
That was the only thing that you really needed to know, right?
It's definitely not investment advice.
Anyway.
But, now, the other thing I was noting was that just a few years ago, the idea of a company becoming a unicorn, $1 billion in valuation, was such a big deal. And now we're throwing around trillion, like, so, you know, trillion isn't what it used to be, sort of a thing. So I jokingly would call that kilocorn as a new metric because it's all going that direction.
Yeah.
So let's talk about AI in general. Chris, you and I have talked and worked on what I call the return of IoT, this time with the smart and connected, smart being underlined. First time around was more connected than smart. Now it's like that's happening. We can chat a little bit about that and the complexities thereof. But yeah.
Part of our conversation is it's a little about today and the weaving of AI into what's going on with IoT. Because as the devices themselves get more powerful in terms of compute capability, I don't know if a light bulb quite gets there, but certainly other devices can. But what does the future look like, right? Where are we actually going? What's the trajectory? And the more I think about it, that of driving intelligence into devices, my head goes toward factory floor type things. I'm not sure how much AI in your coffee pot is going to matter so much, but maybe, I don't know. There's lots of things.
I just put in some motor controller IoT stuff. And one of the options there, basically it monitors the power. It's driving a circulation pump. It's pumping hot water around the house. It monitors how much power is going into it. And there's a little AI option I can subscribe to, which will monitor that. And if the pump fails, it'll say, hey, it's either consuming, if it stalls, it'll probably consume extra power or short out, or it'll be less power, or whatever. It can basically establish what's normal and decide that something's gone wrong with it. And that's what they're selling as their AI monitoring for this particular device.
So a couple of thoughts. One, that's quite deterministic, right? And do you really need AI for that?
No.
Yeah. Okay. truth in advertising.
You can call it AI because it's slightly more intelligent than just putting a threshold on it. But fundamentally, yeah, that's predictive failure. Algorithms have been around for a long time. Hopefully this data isn't being shipped off to be run against, Claude's API or something like that. But yeah, mm-hmm. it is an intelligent thing that they're selling as an AI upgrade to the overall package. Right? I've currently got free cloud access to this thing. I can turn it on and off remotely. And if I buy the upgrade, then they throw in some stuff, including some intelligence, right? Which is configures itself, and I don't have to configure it. I don't have to program in the monitoring of this device. It just says, that looks like what it can figure it out, or ask me questions about what this thing's doing, and then do something sensible. Anyway,
yeah,
it is very difficult to come up with a use case that actually addresses a pain point, because a lot of AI capabilities out there are in the parlance of, is it an aspirin or is it a vitamin? It's mostly vitamin. And vitamin you can do without. Aspirin, you really need it. So,
well, I don't know. I mean, if you are in charge of a large company's manufacturing facilities, for example, aren't you always looking to drive cost out of the equation? And therefore, one of the ways to do that is to go after efficiency.
But to your point, you can do that with like automation rather than AI per se. Now, you could argue that AI is nothing but highly sophisticated automation.
Yeah, it depends on how you turn it. Yeah.
And it's more about the intelligence. With AI, the intelligence to configure itself and to deal with all the weird stuff that you have, right? If you're doing a building management system, one of the annoying things is you don't have one BMS. You have particularly like 10 of them. Or if you have 10 different suppliers, you have 10 different BMSs. They all think they're the one in charge, and you're having to try and get them all to talk to each other in some sensible way. And I think there's and they're all trying to think that there's a human looking at it, right? So if the AI takes the place of the human that's supposed to be running all these different things and making sense of cross-connecting them and configuring them, I think there's a place in that kind of area. And this is energy. I think buildings is a significant proportion of the world's energy goes into buildings. It's, I forget, 15 to 25%, something like that, of the entire energy budget of the world is that. It's much more than data centers historically, right? So optimizing building heating and cooling and lighting there's significant gains, even if you only save a small proportion of it.
So the other angle here was security. Yeah. And Chris, you mentioned Mythos that Anthropic announced and then decided not to distribute beyond a few trusted customers.
Yeah, it was like a handful of companies, right, under Project Glasswing or some such name. And of course, with that announcement, there's a lot of criticism that comes about. Why these companies? Why not everybody? The why not everybody to me is obvious. But then there's also the criticism that, well, tools like that kind of already exist, maybe not on the scale. Is Mythos turning up anything that really isn't being looked at today? But then you look at the other side of the coin, and we've talked about how cyber attacks themselves are going to be increasingly agentic AI. So I think something like 40 or 50% of cyber attacks today or in the very near future are at the very least AI assisted. It just brings up a whole notion. And, we look at the EU, the US, and Japan, all three have some sort of cybersecurity labeling and supply chain tracing regulations out there. US is pretty much voluntary with its CyberMark, except for federal supply chain. That's interesting to me we separating consumer from federal there. But the EU has some pretty, I forget the EU CRA, I forget what that stands for, but they're requiring by the end of 2027, I believe, that anything digital has to go through a certification process, and you can self-certify. That's one of the options. But they're all trying to get at making sure that these devices are quote unquote safe and secure, and not violating privacy or getting at data that you don't want out in the wild. So I think it's just every time you turn around, there's another hairball to be looking at with these.
The other thing that happens is this recurring way is the sort of initial adoption of things by consumers because it does something useful for them and they don't care about the security.
Right. Implications. Absolutely.
We're seeing that with sort of OpenClaw and things like that, the agent automation tools. And I was at a AI conference back in September, the Enterprise AI Summit in San Jose. Gene Kim and the crew were running it. A lot of people there. And before the conference happened, there was sort of a forum where we all met. And surprising number of people running OpenClaw to just run their stuff. And I have a PA that works for me now. I have all these different stuff and they have it. And they're going, yeah, these are experienced computer people just running it at home or running it on their own or running their own little consulting shop, going like, oh, the value of this is too high for me to not do it, right? Mm. And I will deal with the security implications later. And then, so then you see it moving. And this happened with cloud, you know, the initial cloud stuff was people on a credit card standing up doing end runs around IT, right? We've got the same thing happening. So you can't even visit the OpenClaw website. It's completely blocked from a lot of corporate sites. You know, they just block it at the firewall. You can't visit it from work because they don't want people downloading it.
Well,
so the question is, how does that eventually end up as a product that is safe enough to use? And then what you're also seeing is that this is driving very different behavior in the AI modeling space, you know, with Claude or OpenAI. So we're seeing like a lot of people doing very high traffic, because these systems are running continuously. They're reading every email you've got rather than I've got a problem, I'm going to have a little chat with ChatGPT to solve a problem. This thing is just running in the background all the time. And people are running simpler home-hosted models, privately hosted models, just so that they're not hitting the APIs is one way around it. But they're driving massive amounts of token usage in a different pattern. So we're now seeing Anthropic and people like that changing the way that they're doing their product and licensing models in order to do this. So they're sort of separating out the API calling from the interactive as a separate thing.
Well, that also touches on, so as we know, people are using Claude Code, and I forget the name of the ChatGPT tool, that's the equivalent, but in enterprise environments to develop code, right? And you can develop code way faster these days than you have the ability to check it or ensure that what you're putting into your code base is secure or not going to do some harm or create some exposure. So I just think that's an interesting conundrum that we find ourselves in. You know, on the one hand, the productivity, I don't know how much AI slop is generated in code. I know that in my little app development, I have to say, hey, wait a minute. And I know nothing about coding really, but I have to say, wait a minute, that's not behaving properly. And Claude Code comes back and says, oh, you're right. I should have thought of that. I'm like, well, but if you bring that up to the enterprise level, I mean, you know, what are the implications?
So one thing I gathered from Adrian, your commentary a couple of times ago was that if you're doing this, you need to have all your test procedures up front.
Yeah.
So that you can verify that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. Point one. Point two, a lot of these apps are what I call single user apps. Somebody's doing it for themselves because they kind of like it and they know. So, but if you are going to scale it to other people, or if you're doing something whose errors could cause substantial damage, then you're back to the normal way of doing code generation. And you need not just human in the loop, but human accountability for the scale to happen. So I feel like when enterprises use it, it's going to be a different model. But this is not a bad segue into the no man's land.
Yeah, I think there's certainly more guardrails around it. And there's a lot of process you can put around checking the output. I mean, the AI models are actually better at checking their own code that they just wrote than writing it in the first place. It's just a standard asymmetry of, you know, it's easier to critique something than to do it. That's always been true. So you can build things which will verify and check the code. I think that the interesting thing, just to go on the thing that I've been building for a little while, using Instar, which is a very simplified kind of OpenClaw like thing. Basically, I send text messages to the system, which is running on a server in my house, and it's the domain is to just do some home automation and track all and build a knowledge graph of all the things in my house. So that's what I'm doing. But I'm developing it by just talking over an iMessage account to this thing. And the back end of that is an interactive Claude that wakes up, sees the message, writes the code, does the thing. And I'm not looking at I'm just seeing if it did the thing. Right? I'm not reading the code. I'm not even looking at that. I'm sending text messages to it to do the development now. And I'm getting and it's working pretty well as a way of doing stuff. I don't have to go find a computer if I have an idea or just send a message. And it's running there all the time. It can have little scheduled jobs that it does and things like that. However, when I was trying to sort of port it to how I want to do a second installation of it, I said, okay, put stuff up in a repo where the other one can see it. And when it pulled down like hundreds of megabytes of stuff. So that's a bit big. What is in this thing? And so it checked in a whole bunch of stuff that shouldn't have been there. So like, okay. Once I cleaned it out, it turned out it was about 2 megabytes of stuff. Right? The actual code itself that I generated, but it had uploaded type databases and a whole bunch of stuff it shouldn't have put there. So I had to go clear out the GitHub history and tidy it up and don't do that again and whatever, right? So it will do things that are, and that's the sort of information leakage security issue, if you like. There wasn't anything critical in there particularly, but it was just a whole lot of I was trying to clone a running system and it uploaded too much of the running system when I told it. I just wanted it to upload the scripts, but I had to kind of verify that. But I knew to look and I caught it doing that, right? So that's some of the sort of human guardrails and things that you can put around it. Anyway, so going back to this conference I was at, the Enterprise AI Summit, there's a couple of things going on around there. There's a group of us writing a paper on continuous decision intelligence, and CDI has been around for a while, it's sort of supply chain optimization. But if you do agentic CDI, we're then getting a lot more optimization of the business processes and the ability to respond to changes in the business. And in particular, where you've got very rapid or unplanned things happening in the business, like tariffs, wars, pandemics, that kind of stuff. How does your business respond and can it respond? And can you use the agentic CDI to basically deploy more, react more quickly? And then you get into sort of this OODA loop thing. Can you react more quickly than the competition? And then, not everyone survives the tariffs or the wars or whatever, but the ones that are most agile are most likely to. So that's kind of we're writing a paper on that. And then on Monday, I was chatting to somebody at the beginning of the day saying, we can't figure out which stack is good for which language and which options, and there's too many frameworks. I turn over a rock, there's yet another framework for managing the memory systems inside your development, whatever. So we need a way to test this, and we should test all the different stacks and do it properly. And then I said, well, I should just go start writing that. So I fired up a Gastown agent automation system. And it was about 10 a.m. And my talk was at 3 p.m. And by 3 p.m., I'd built the whole thing, put it up there. It's in my GitHub account. It's called Retort because it distills the good AI stacks out of the ones that don't work, sort of picks out the best ones. So that's what chemistry Retort does. It came up with that name. And there's a fair amount of code there, and it's got, a few hundred or something GitHub stars and a few issues and whatever. And a few days ago, I went back to it and found, okay, there's a pull request and some issues that have been filed. So I just told Claude, read the issues, read the pull requests, go incorporate them, just go and do it, right? That's all I really had to do. And it said, yeah, these are interesting things. It just figured out how to update the repo for me. So that's an interesting way. I decided something needed to exist. It's got proper statistical design of experiments in there. It's doing analysis of variance. You can do fractional testing because there's too many permutations to do exhaustive testing of all the combinatorics, all the permutations that you might have of different stacks for different languages. And it basically says, yep, the language you should be writing everything is in probably Go. And because that's the one that seems to use the fewest tokens and have the highest, the most likely to produce you a good answer from the agent developing tooling that's out there right now. And that was, and Sonnet's about as good as opus it turned out for that. So yeah, just that was the kind of things that came out of it. I need to do a bit more work on it, which I'll probably over the next week or so, maybe by the time this podcast comes out, I'll actually have spent a bit more time on it. But that was an example of having an idea, basically starting a guest on while I was sitting in the audience of a conference, just having it go and build this thing for me with a bit of input every now and again to get it built, right?
So we've talked about the impact of this on your organizational structure.
Yeah, so that was the other thing. I got this idea in my head, partly out of that CDI, Continuous Decision Intelligence thing, was that we're starting to see management replaced by agents. This is sort of what OpenClaw does with having a PA. And when I'm seeing some people replacing more, you know, the whole, you know, financial organizational operations teams that you'd normally staff up with a company be replaced. And so this phrase came into my head, we're entering no man's land, where it means no management. There are no humans doing the management. And so I wrote that. And so again, it was during that conference, I think I just fired off this. I had the idea in my head, I had to write it down. So there's a little post that I put out there. And I showed it to somebody and he said, oh yeah, there's this thing called Paperclip. And I had to go find that. And that's actually a package that somebody wrote, which implements all corporate structure as agentic tooling. And there's another one called, I think, cofounder.co or something. Anyway, if you go find my Medium post, I've got links to these. As these frameworks appear and I hear of them, I'm just adding them to the blog post. And there's a fair amount, I think there's something to this. People are able to do most of the things that you would normally hire people to do in terms of just all that management stuff that you need to just get a company to run, but that stuff is automatable. The actual product the company is building, if it's software, that's automatable. But if it's moving atoms around, then, you know, the robotics isn't really there to just do that in a general sense. So the companies that are interesting right now are the ones that are actually moving things around in the real world, I think.
So then what is this I read about? The fears of AI impacting organizational structure and employment are overstated, that it, you know, may or may not happen, and et cetera, because like I see it actually happening. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the Bill Joy thing of you tend to underestimate change in the short term and overestimate. Right. You know, it's an exponential thing, right? So the impact of change is less than you thought in the short term. And then it crosses over and it's a larger impact in the long term. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what is that term? And I think in the AI world we're in, that inflection point is actually closer than it has been in previous, like, industrial revolutions, if you like, just because the rate of diffusion of these capabilities is really high.
Right. So along these lines, and we're going to have to come to data centers and crypto and Bitcoin in a bit. But one other thing that Chris and I experienced recently was this kind of notion of getting pushed around by AI. Since AI comes to the scene with the reputation of having read everything that was ever written, you sort of take its opinion seriously. Now, if you're close to the scene, if you are an expert yourself, you can arbitrate. You can say that, okay, no, you can push back, or you can tell that it is like not good. But if you're a couple of steps removed, you're totally liable to fall for it. And guess who is a step or two removed? It could be your boss, or it could be your boss's boss, who are probably awesome at what they do, but probably not as much of an expert in what you do as you are. And if AI disagrees with you because the prompt was like not quite well formed, that could be a problem. So I think the idea of getting pushed around by AI is another issue in organizations. I used to joke that if AI wants to get rid of you, undermine you, it will create a 10-page document, well-written, well-articulated on why the boss should get rid of. So like, be really worried if AI gets on your wrong side. But, you know, joking aside, it's like a big issue. So I think that's another impact on organization that needs to be understood.
Well, we've all been part of companies where we've seen the waves of layoffs in the past, right? And we're certainly going through that in the tech sector today. But then there's this less than headline or attention grabbing phenomenon that happens where the people just gradually get hired back because the gaps are surfaced, one, to the financial position of the company is okay. It's not like, and they, you know, tend to oversteer when doing the layoffs, in my not so humble opinion. And so I kind of wonder what, you know, will that happen here? Because we're seeing some of the gaps for human interference or human arbitration is needed, in the case of AI. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there that there might be this creeping back of people in certain roles.
I think you get the leading indicators and trailing indicators things. We saw this with cloud and various other over the years, right? The first people to adopt something, they're doing it cheaply with few people. So it doesn't impact the rest of the market because the market isn't there. Like for years, the enterprise tech sector was focused on data centers because that's where the money was being spent. And cloud was this little thing on the side, but it's where the new stuff was happening. And so, and the developers were happening there. And I think we're going to see something similar happening here as well. Right? There, people are going to create entire companies with a handful of people that just suddenly start taking over a market, and it's too late. All right. So, if you're an existing company, you can optimize using AI, and there's a number of things there. But I think it's the new from scratch companies are going to be like whatever AI native or something, or agentic native companies. There can be some new category, and they're going to do it on pennies. And so there isn't a big market there, and it isn't a lot of people, and they won't appear on the radar on the metrics because they're not in the right category. But eventually they'll start taking over the markets of the other ones, of the existing incumbents, and that's then it's usually too late. It's a classic innovative dilemma.
It's definitely shifting the competitive landscape because they could come out of nowhere, and it's not the usual suspects that's going to compete with you. Now, another topic.
I'm talking to some startups right now, and they're trying to figure out how to get funded, or even if they do need to get funded, and
right.
They're building out of almost no people to build something that would have been a 50 to 100 person startup, spending a few years trying to build a product. They've already built a product.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I have seen VCs reject investment in companies whose code was generated by AI. They think that that's not sufficiently robust. And I don't exactly remember what application it was, because if it is like a healthcare thing, as I like to say, if it's heart surgery or, you know, send man to the moon, maybe not. But I also don't know if that was the case. I think it was just lack of confidence in what AI can do right now. But I want to switch now to data centers and AI before we go to crypto. And we all know that finding land and power and cooling is the number one problem. Money is the first thing, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. But those others are. And that has pushed people to look at where else can I have a data center? Microsoft has this Project Natick, as they used to call it a couple of years ago, when they had a capsule and they basically put it underwater, and it was off the coast of Ireland or something, and it was sitting on the ocean floor for a couple of years, and they filled it with nitrogen gas and they experimented with how that works. Now, water is salty, that's not good. Underwater cables, that's hard. But the systems actually had 1/8, if I remember, of instances of failure. So their reliability actually was kind of enhanced. But then that has led folks like Musk to want to do data centers in space because, well, of course, he's got a SpaceX. And then Peter Thiel just invested in this company that does data centers that are just bobbing up and down on the ocean surface. Let's chat a little bit about that. Do you guys see a future in these things?
Well, you know, one of the latest data center projects to grab headlines was Kevin O'Leary and his data center in Utah. Saw a headline just the other day saying, new data center twice the size of Manhattan. And some people in Utah, a lot of people in Utah are up in arms, and we're seeing objections from local folks about data centers. So yes, there is pressure on finding other places. Space, you know, we all collectively kind of laugh at that, but maybe space to Earth isn't quite the end goal that people initially think of. If we're thinking about serving space travel or other non-sovereign uses of data in space, then maybe that's okay. You know, and in terms of the data centers in the ocean, there are local environmental challenges there too, with the heat being transferred. So,
yeah, I think if you think of telecom as moving to satellite-based, then you want the computing things that you want to do in the telecom network to be up there as well. So I think there is a use case for it in that, given that the various satellite networks that are starting to supply Wi-Fi and eventually cell phones that can pick up satellites, right? So that's, I think, the main short-term use case for it. But there's so many challenges. It's such an expensive place to put stuff up. It's, you know, you have all the other reliability, heating, cooling, you know, cosmic rays. There's a bunch of things that will cause you to have much more problems than if you put something in a nice inert constant temperature thing underwater or whatever, right? That's a different
I think problem. Having computers in space for use by whatever equipment is up there because they need it is one thing. And it's unlikely that they're going to need an AI factory to do whatever it is that they're doing. But to actually have massive data centers to serve customers on Earth is a whole different ballgame in terms of the weight and the heat removal, etc. But all of these stories have some compelling angle that says, well, I don't need land. I don't need land use permits. I don't need to deal with ordinances. Power is there, you know, 24/7 if I do it right. And, you know, so those reel you in, and then you have to kind of make it work. And then the complexity shows up. All right. Crypto, Dr. Perino, you've been busy with,
Yeah, you know, I occasionally people talk about, Bitcoin mining on the moon, and it's just insane because even to go to low Earth orbit, the cost to lift the server up is 100 times what the server costs. And Bitcoin mining, crypto mining for the ones that have proof of work is an extremely brutally competitive business. So the biggest thing that's been going on is that, you know, the last few years, the mining has been dominated by publicly funded venture capital, you know, supplied and debt raising companies, publicly traded mostly in North America. This was after China, you know, didn't completely ban, but really cracked down on mining there, that the U.S. became the largest site for Bitcoin mining, which is most of the hash. You know, there's some other going on, but really most of the economic value in the hashing and the computing power is with Bitcoin itself. Such that now, of course, these guys used to be the boogeyman for the use of electricity, right? And there were people, I remember, I think it was 2017, a guy at Lawrence Berkeley Lab said, crypto is going to consume, you know, all of our energy pretty soon. And I wrote a rebuttal. And of course, it has not happened. It's still a fraction of 1%. And they're no longer the boogeyman because data centers AI have become the boogeyman for electrical power consumption, and they're going to consume a lot more. And so, in fact, the guys that want to do Bitcoin mining are in competition with trying to get that. Now, they have some advantages, which is they've been operating on the frontier. They've been operating out of necessity in order to be competitive with the cheapest sources of power, which tend to be, you know, less than 5 cents a kilowatt hour and located in places like, at least in the U.S., West Texas, where you've got a lot of solar and wind, or, you know, close to hydropower. Those have typically been the lowest costs. Or if you have stranded natural gas, where people are otherwise flaring methane, which is very bad, sometimes venting methane, which is even worse. So Bitcoin has been greener than most. It's been more than 50% green, and it can go capture this low cost. It doesn't need a lot of bandwidth. You know, because you chug for 10 minutes and you hope you win a block. And if you win a block, you're only transmitting a few megabytes. You know, it's very cheap from bandwidth. So they can be in remote locations. But they're all under pressure because the hash rates are now up to a zettahash collectively across the Bitcoin network. The difficulty and the hash rate, and the difficulty is just another way of stating that, has been rising as a very steep power of Bitcoin's age. And then, of course, the rewards get cut in half every 4 years with these halvings. So they're all going into AI and HPC, and they've been doing that for more than a year. But in the last 6 months, there have been some very large deals announced. Two of the largest were Core Scientific and Hut 8. Core Scientific in particular with CoreWeave. And they're talking about $10 billion worth of contracts and over $3 billion worth of debt financing to try to make all that work. Hut 8, which is actually a Canadian company, but they have mining both in Canada and the U.S., going into what they say is hyperscaling AI and HPC, and they claim to have $9.8 billion worth of infrastructure agreement. Mara is another one, and Iron, which is actually an Australian company, between $1.5 billion and $2 billion is what they're saying. So they're all headed that way so that they can participate in the growth and compete better for, you know, electricity supply. But they're also efficient operators. So they've got the infrastructure. They've got the low-cost electricity. They've got experience. They've been water cooling their systems increasingly. And so they're actually in a good position to be providers of low-cost energy to, you know, AI consumers in terms of the hyperscalers.
What does that mean for the chips that we're focused on hashing, like the ones from Antminer, compared to GPUs that are needed for AI? Does that mean these guys are switching to GPUs?
Yeah, they have to swap out because the ASICs are 10,000 to 100,000 times faster than the GPUs. They're just, you know, one miner might have three boards, and those boards will have hundreds of thousands of units, and those units are heavily pipelined. In fact, it's interesting. It's a 64 deep. It's almost like the original Cray 1. The process that they go through for the SHA-256 is, so they just pipeline it through. They have many, many functional units. And the parallelism is like 100,000 way parallelism that they build into these. And that's how they get hundreds of terahashes out of a single box, you know, 1U, 2U kind of box.
So when they switch to AI, they stop doing hashing, or they do it on the GPUs at lower efficiency?
No, they're not doing hashing at all.
They're just like out, okay.
So they're going to continue. Well, I'm not saying that they abandon hashing, but their expansion is into AI with GPUs.
They've got like the hash zone and the AI zone.
Separate zone. Yeah, separate zone.
Adrian, you were saying?
I think for training, you ship all the data over that you're going to train on. And training takes a lot of compute power. And the resulting model is not that big, right? So, and it's the latency is not such an issue. So I could see that if you're a remote place that's not very well connected on the network, that AI training is going to be a reasonable fit. I think it's more challenging if you're doing inference. Mm-hmm. And most of the work is moving to inference, right? So that's where you do need your network. There'll be a fair amount of traffic because you're shipping in the prompts and the data that's going to be collected and processed, right? And the results. So there's a lot more interactivity and bandwidth needed there. So I think they've got chunks of the market they could address, but the premium is going to be on, can you get networking, you know, dropped into these places as well as power.
So the other kind of big things that are going on in general with Bitcoin in the market is that, you know, we had a big downdraft in Q4. It peaked the first week of October. And the price got cut in half. And it dropped from a little over 125,000 to a low around 61,000 first week of February. And it seems to have recovered since then. And actually, after the Iran war started, it's been the best general asset class. And gold had been doing very well, but gold has not done well since then. Because Bitcoin is something that Iran is willing to accept as a currency. In fact, they explicitly stated that the fees for passage, that they will accept Bitcoin for that. And there's rumors that maybe oil, you know, is sometimes paid for in Bitcoin terms as well as won terms. So there's been this idea that the petrodollar is losing, you know, some of its heft, right? And so then people look at Bitcoin as a possible alternative down the road. It cannot be that immediately because it's not of the scale of gold or the euro or the yuan at this point. So it's not a fully developed alternative. But given the power law sort of behavior, it could start to be that in a decade's time. So it's bounced back, and Saylor has been buying, you know, for strategy, hand over fist. So he's been competing with the largest ETF. They're both above 800,000. The sovereign Bitcoin holdings are increasing. The U.S. is really not going to sell theirs now, and they've got over 300,000. China's rumored to have over 100,000. There are some smaller nations that are doing sovereign mining, including Bhutan and the UAE, as well as El Salvador. And now the bill is going through Congress. It looks like they've figured out the compromises on that. It's called Clarity Act. And it's going to provide more clarity around crypto coins and stable coins and allow for people that develop coins or tokens that are open source to not be burdened with the regulations around money transfer, for example, which has been a big concern for them. So I think a lot of the regulatory stuff is getting sorted out, and that's going to be supportive for the market.
Now, it's true that the regulations were, in fact, not clear, that even companies who really were working hard to adhere to the laws didn't know what the laws were, and the authorities were not clarifying it. I think that's where the name of the bill comes from, right?
And they've, you know, sorted out between who does what, who regulates what. So there's a role for the CFTC. There's a role for the SEC. Right. There's a role for the banking system because banks are now going to be able to custody and can now already custody Bitcoin for clients. And in fact, we're seeing direct offering of Bitcoin by the largest brokers, including Schwab and Fidelity, are going to be offering that directly as a retail offering as well as their ETFs.
If you don't mind just explaining what Mike Saylor and MicroStrategy, now called Strategy, are doing with sort of the different, like you can buy the share and other, because I think Bitcoin has kind of moved beyond just buying it to buying derivatives of it. And that's an interesting development that he's been driving in substantial ways.
Sure. All of the net buying, pretty much, since about 3 years ago, has been institutional. And you had a trust, you had the Grayscale Trust, and you had some treasury companies, Saylor being the most notable. He started that Bitcoin treasury company strategy in August of 2020. It really got going after a couple of years. But the ETFs started at the beginning of 2024. So the ETFs, and then Grayscale converted theirs. But the ETFs like the BlackRock and a dozen others, and treasury companies like Saylor and many others, have basically been the net buyers over the last couple of years. And their buying has been growing, you know, kind of like as a power law, just the way the price also tends to track a power law. What the treasury companies do, and they have different models, but what Saylor in particular has done initially was issue equity and debt, including convertible debt. And he tried several different forms of that. He had STRK that has a kicker, so it's a convertible. And so if the underlying MSTR equity reaches a certain value, then there's a conversion for that. And he had some other, you know, more senior and less senior securities, STRD, and even had one that he introduced in Europe. But he really kind of hit on the silver bullet late last year with STRC. And what STRC is, nicknamed Stretch, is permanent preferred security, which offers a high yield. And it was announced at 9%, but it's adjustable. So he can adjust it down or he can adjust it up. And the intent is to keep it at par. So it's issued at $100. Occasionally, there's been some market turbulence where it dropped as low as about 95. But now it really stays very close to $100, and they've able to adjust the yield, which right now is 11.5% and paid monthly. And in fact, they're going to revise that. There's a voting for it. It's going to pass to pay twice a month. And so what he does is he issues that into the marketplace, and he uses that as the primary vehicle to raise capital by which he buys Bitcoin and increases his treasury holdings, which are now over 800,000, and which rival the size of the largest ETF, which is BlackRock. I've just written a couple of articles analyzing that whole model to see how long the legs are, given the framework of Bitcoin Power Law, which says that you've got high returns, but they're going to gradually decrease. You've also got high volatility, and that's coming down over time. What does that all mean with his ability to issue at double-digit yields? But it looks like there's runway out the next dozen years or so, out into 2040 timeframe.
One other thing to ask you is the state of the Scientific Bitcoin Institute that you and Giovanni have been building.
Yes. Well, we founded it at the beginning of this year. It was established in California. It has offices in Italy and here in Thailand. And we've added a few staff. I'm the associate director. Giovanni Santostasi, who is a physicist, is the director. We have some funding from a VC that's Bitcoin focused in Europe. And we've started to fund partnerships with universities to broaden out the research agenda. One of those is the Polytech in Turin, which is known as the MIT of Italy. Another one is one in Taiwan that is strong in economics and finance. And so we're going to be funding a project there that's related to really a sidechain, the liquid sidechain. The group in Turin is a cryptography group. So that's going to be quite interesting to get their input. And there's some other, you know, researchers that we have conversations with. I think there's also one in Switzerland in Lugano, another university there that wants to have a connection with Giovanni. But the big news is that we've written our first scientific paper. It's been put up on the CERN preprint site. It's had 11,000 views and 9,000 downloads, which is extremely viral for a paper that's only been up like 5 weeks or so, I think. And so, yeah,
and
so
given the topic,
it's been
really
a huge hit, and we've submitted it to a journal of nonlinear science, and it's out for review. So waiting for the reviews to come back and see whether it's accepted or what kind of modifications are asked for. But it basically lays out, you know, three ways in which we prove the power law nature or establish the long-term power law nature of Bitcoin, which grows in price at nearly the sixth power of its age as a function of two underlying power laws, one of which is the adoption, which is spread virally. And it turns out that viruses will spread as power laws, and that those are often seen to spread at something like 2 to 3. And what we've seen for Bitcoin, it's the power of 3. It's like the cube of the age. And then there's Metcalfe's law, which is the law of how networks scale, particularly communication networks and social networks. And that includes the internet. And the idea there is that the value goes roughly as the square of the number of users, because you can talk to many more people. Well, with Bitcoin, you can exchange value with many more people or with companies. And also the fact that companies and exchanges get on there provides stability to the network and transform it from exponential growth to more stable parallel growth. So that's all covered and very well established, you know, with statistical methods, multiple methods in that paper. There's a second paper that we're working on that's going to talk about how the residuals behave. And I've written the first draft of that, and we've got to do some work on it internally, but we will go with the same sort of process of posting as a preprint. And once we get the other paper accepted, then we'll submit that one to a journal. Mm-hmm. And then very importantly, I've got a prop.
I was just going to bring it up.
The Physics of Bitcoin book, which is a beautiful soft cover. It's a little bit expensive because it's, 500 pages, 477 pages, but a beautiful book that Giovanni wrote, and I had the pleasure to write the foreword work, and a lot of beautiful graphs in there, as well as Johannes Kepler and some other scientists' pictures. So if people want to understand the physics of Bitcoin, this is the first truly, I would say, scientific book about Bitcoin. There have been many that have written that have been quite good, but they come at it from finance and, I would say, philosophy and economics directions.
Excellent. All right. Good chat here. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, gentlemen, for this session. Until next time. All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Yes. Bye.
That's it for this episode of the OrionX Download Podcast. Every episode is posted to orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comment section or tweet us with any questions or proposed topics of discussion. If you like the show, rate, review, and share it. The OrionX Download Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.